This pandemic and the situation in our lives in South Africa is a traumatic event, but it may not be easy to recognize it as one because it's happening more slowly than normal trauma. An analogy might be a car crash. This is not the quick slam and aftermath we might normally associate with a traumatic event. It's more like being a part of a multiple vehicle collision in slow motion. Most of us might be a little bit up the road, but we're seeing it unfold in front of us, and we're doing all the calculations that will help us stop, swerve, or hit the pileup in such a way that we minimize damage to ourselves and others. As the lockdown drags on and the economic and social results of the pandemic start to appear, I think that our mental health will be more and more affected. To help us understand what we're going through right now and prepare for what's to come, we've connected with Amanda Reichardt, a specialist trauma counselor and educator in the field. Now, before we kind of move on to the conversation, and given the amount of ridiculous misinformation flying around on the internet right now, I think it's important to take a minute here to introduce Amanda's background. HPCSA registered counselor specializing in trauma and crisis. She's got 20 years of experience in the field, has guest lectured on the topic at the University of Pretoria, and has volunteered her time and expertise to assist the military, police, patients in mental hospitals, NGOs, and especially first responder organizations. She focuses on facilitating clients in crisis, specializing in trauma and life crises, group trauma debriefings, critical incident stress debriefing, victim empowerment, advising corporations on mental health issues and employee wellness. I've stalked of her. Amanda believes in a holistic approach to mental health, incorporating the dimensions of physical, emotional, social, intellectual, and spiritual wellness. And her practice includes counseling services, positive psychology, mindful living, psychoeducation, and destigmatization of mental health issues, especially around the subject of trauma. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us and taking your time out of your day to chat to us.
Thank you for the invitation and for having me here.
Great. So when I made that little car crash analogy, it was just kind of something that popped into my head. Do you think that's right? Do you think this is more like a slow motion traumatic event than what was the standard definition of the quick trauma?
Definitely, because when people undergo a trauma, it's always a very individual subjective response. There are so many factors considered, and one of the factors that actually leads to the extent of the trauma is the length of the incident, how long the incident lasted. So what we're dealing with here is this incredibly long, extended, ongoing traumatic experience, which by definition, it does fit into all the categories that defines it as a trauma. But the length of time is something that we absolutely have never dealt with before. You would normally see somebody after effects of a trauma can last for such a long time, but not the actual event. Right. So this is totally new territory and new waters for everybody.
Right. I should also mention that Lucas is here. Hi, Luke.
Yeah, I just want to say hi. I'm here as well.
I did it again.
Yeah, but it's all good. I reckon just keep going.
Eh? Sure.
So find things to compare this to. And I keep saying, like, trying to explain to people, a tsunami has hit the country, an earthquake has hit the country. There is no handbook. You don't know what the damage is. It's basically you deal with it as you can. So if imagine you were in an earthquake, it'd be like, yeah, but why can't I go for a run? It's like, okay, cool. Comparatively, it's not such a big problem. What I'm finding interesting is that people are trying to compare it to something, but it seems that they just keep on being outraged. And I don't know if it's misplaced outrage or maybe it's because we're just on social media, and that tends to be a bit of a poison as well.
Ooh, I can talk about 3 hours about what you just said there.
Sorry.
But I won't.
Good, that's why we're here.
Just to go back to the car crash analogy or the earthquake analogy, normally a car crash and an earthquake it's an event, and then you have the after effects of the event. With us, it's very much the event hasn't come to fruition yet. It hasn't come to conclusion yet. Hmm. We still don't know where the peak is going to be. That tsunami is still coming towards us.
Yeah.
We have to rely on data that we get from all over the world to see when is it going to hit us to this extent. So very much what we're dealing with here is that old adage of the anticipation of the event is a thousand times more than the event itself. Mm. So we are still anticipating. We are still trying to wrap our minds around this, that we have no idea where this is going. We have no idea how this is going to affect us personally or as a country, as a world. So that is a very big part of why we are all hanging in limbo, why you have anger issues everywhere, why you've had this change of response, why things have changed so drastically since last week when we spoke for the first time, Jonathan, and since this week. And the whole perception and the whole mindset of everybody in the country and world over has changed. We didn't just move down into stage four of lockdown. We moved into a total different stage of how we're dealing with this, because the dynamics have changed, the variables have changed, and we still don't know when we get into the end of this. So we can't even start talking about the after effects of dealing with the trauma, because we haven't really dealt with the full trauma, because it hadn't really happened fully yet, if that makes sense. We're still in the anticipatory sense. We're still waiting for whatever it is going to be.
It's torturous, actually. It's like this idea of the bully never actually hitting you. I know what you're saying. You can fight kind of,
Yes, it's like the fake punch.
And we are terrified because we have no idea what's going to happen. So as human beings are, I've often made the analogy to Stephen King. Stephen King is one of my favorite authors, Stephen King and Shakespeare. And the thing that they had in common was they have this amazing ability to observe the human condition and human behavior and describe that. When Shakespeare described Lady Macbeth's descent into madness in 1600 and something, there wasn't such a thing as madness. But the way he did it will stand up in any textbook, in a psychological textbook today. Any Stephen King, people always say, Stephen King horror, when you read Stephen King, he doesn't write about horror. That's just the context that he writes in. He writes about human behavior. And he always writes about human behavior under extraordinary conditions that, like horror, something you would never in your life imagine. And when this whole pandemic started, being into psychology, I love watching human behavior. It's what we do. We analyze human behavior. So it was great. I mean, I had this front row seat, sitting back and watching on in the different communities and with clients and in the media as well, how people are going through these stages. And I think Stephen King should have been here. He's probably writing about this in America. So we are very much in a Stephen King novel with something unexpected happening. We have no idea where it's going. We've never dealt with this before. And we are doing what humans do best, and that's trying to deal and just messing everything up along the way.
Which I think is kind of another, I saw a post yesterday, which was, I think was quite good, just talking about, and it's something I've thought as well, is that there are mistakes being made all over the world with the response to the pandemic. And I think when you're in the mire of social media and all that, it's easy to get lost in that. But I think we should extend a little bit of understanding to the leaders and the people who are trying to respond to this, knowing that they've never faced anything like this before. And in our government's case, have never been trained to face anything like this before. A lot of ministers are political appointees who don't necessarily have any particular expertise in the field that they are now suddenly in charge of during the middle of this massive problem. Let's go back to the difference between level 5 lockdown and level 4 lockdown. How did you see a change in tone, in perspective from the people around you and your clients?
Well, when it started in December in China, it was very much that feeling as it is with a lot of traumatic events. You know it's out there, but it doesn't affect you directly. So until it's something you read about, it's interesting, and it's distant, it's removed, so it doesn't really affect us. So when it started getting closer to home and sort of moving down through some of the African countries as well, I think we all started getting a bit panicky. When it finally hit South Africa, we knew it was coming, and then it was here. But at that stage, it was in Gauteng, it wasn't in Cape Town yet. So gradually and gradually it became closer, and that awareness became closer. Well, you know, this is getting a bit too close to home for us. Then finally, when the lockdown was announced, there were some people that were outraged, but we were more scared than anything. So I would say for the first, how many days were we in stage one
of lockdown? 28 or so?
30,
it was 3 weeks initially, and then they extended it by, was it a week or 2 weeks?
Yes. Okay. So in a lot of ways, what you saw in the first part, in stage one lockdown, you had, for the first time ever, A lot of South Africans had the feeling that I'm part of this country, because the way that President Ramaphosa brought that over to us, he was talking as one of us. He wasn't talking as a politician. He wasn't talking as the leader of the ANC. Mm. He wasn't talking as the for a specific group. He was talking about the whole of South Africa, and that made it a lot easier, because I think a lot of people got the feeling, you know, we can do this, we're in this together. Mm. Feeling patriotic for the first time in how many years, and we're all in this together. We can suck it up for 3 weeks and we can do this. And there was almost a sense of excitement, you know, a lot of people, yeah, 3 weeks of work, 3 weeks to stay at home, let's do this and let's do that, this is gonna be a great holiday time. Which it was in a lot of ways. And interesting enough, a lot of people's mental health improved in the first 3 weeks of lockdown, especially people who had been in abusive relationships before, who had experienced some kind of trauma, who had been victims of crime, who had been victims of accident, because you were locked up safely in your own home. So at that stage, and with a curfew as well, and crime figures started going down, everybody felt safe at home, because the enemy was still out there and our daily enemies couldn't enter. Sure. So we were quite happy being alone at home. Okay, and then things started changing, of course, with the whole announcement of the cigarettes. And what I keep on saying, it's not about the cigarettes. There was so much more lost with that announcement. Because first, you know, the whole debacle about Dr. Dlamini Zuma, and the politics that could have been behind that, and the fact that it was the president's decision that was overthrown, and the president didn't immediately come to release a statement. He only released a statement for the first time yesterday. So I think what happened in that minute, by the end of lockdown, we were still scared. We didn't know where we're going to from this. Mm. And the minute that announcement was made, we lost the trust that everybody had in the president. And it was like everything that held us together for the first few weeks of lockdown absolutely shattered. And the biggest response you had about then is anger. A lot of people came out anger. Civil disobedience. I'm not a smoker. That very next day, I went out into the closest township I could, and I went and I bought illegal cigarettes. And I was so disappointed that I wasn't arrested, because I was so angry, because it's all about your rights that were being violated. You are not being heard. Mm. The person that we trusted in for the past how many weeks, we are lost. We are scared. This person that we trusted to lead us through this turned out to be not as trustworthy as we thought he might be. So immediately there was this massive reaction where people still are. You saw civil disobedience rising at provincial levels in the, since last week. And then you have everybody turning on one another, which has got another dynamic behind that. So we are in that angry stage, because we're in that very scared stage. We are starting to mistrust all the data coming our way, because where's the scientific data? Everybody says data is not being, it's not being compared.
It's being interpreted in strange ways, yeah. For purposes, ulterior motives.
We're not comparing apples to apples. The testing hasn't been done, which inherently makes the data flawed. So we are still very much left in the dark. But this time, since last week, I think we are all feeling incredibly isolated. We feel like we're being dumped. We're just left to our own devices. We have lost that cohesion feeling we've had. And that brings out the really ugly side in human behavior, is everybody for himself. Every man's fighting for himself for survival now. And I think that's where we are. And I see that increasing by the day.
Right.
If President Ramaphosa had said something within the first few hours, or if that decision had been overthrown, or if he had commented, things would have been different. But he waited nearly a week before he released a statement saying that he supported that. So he has lost all the support in the country, and that had a massive, massive psychological implication on the rest of the country.
I think it kind of brought into focus the fact that the ANC is still, and the government is still, a political machine and a mess of one, and the fact that Ramaphosa doesn't have the power that we hope he does, because in our minds, and maybe there's a psychological thing here, in that he's the country's dad, and he became the country's dad in his first speech, and to see him kind of emasculated by his own ministers was obviously very scary, because it's to see your dad beaten in a fight, essentially.
That's where our anger comes from as well, because we have been, we've almost been orphaned and we've almost been cheated. Because after the 9 years of Zuma in charge, for the first time in 9 years, there was a little bit of hope that we're actually going somewhere, and that hope has been obliterated. So that trauma of the Zuma years and that anger we've tried to put aside, we managed to put that aside because we had something to believe in. And now that belief is gone. So we are not just going back to the start of lockdown. We're going back to the start of the Zuma years and that trauma that hasn't been resolved yet. So there's a lot of anger and a lot of hurt from that era that is still coming through. And that disillusionment that how are we ever going to trust our own government again? And where do we go if we can't trust our own government? Sorry, I'm not trying to make this political, but it has an immense impact on people's mental status and the anger. That's what worries me incredibly, because I sometimes feel to myself that I have this need to just pick a fight with somebody because I need to vent that anger. So what's been happening now, we are angry at our government. We are angry at the world. We are angry at the Chinese. We are angry at this pandemic because and who do we turn to? You turn to the person who's in lockdown with you. You turn to your neighbor who's out walking their dog when they're not supposed to be walking their dog. So we've become these petty, nitpicking, disgruntled, horrible little people in the past week because we don't know where to vent our anger, where to direct our anger. And underneath all that anger is hurt. It's previous hurt. It's being, it's almost like being thrown away again. And I think a lot of people feel that. And there's absolutely no hope for the future. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, not if I can, this is and I found that whenever we talk about these things, we tend to kind of whinge. We're all sitting in this thing, going like, how this was that, this is wrong, this is wrong. We can't do anything about it right now. So, and that's the input. I think there's an impotence. I feel impotent in this scenario because I can't control what Ramaphosa does. I can't control what the police do. I can't control these stupid rules that are coming out of it for some reason. And I'm now that I might be being done in for inciting violence, but I think people should be angry. I think it's a complete natural response in order for to be heard. So if at the moment you can't protest, and our country is built on this idea of protesting, and there's no more reason. They've inflamed that. And I think the change or action happens because you're forced to do it in politics especially. And I think there will be a better outcome to this because our liberties have been taken away. People will now go, oh, wait a second. This is what a democracy is. This is what we voted for. I understand now. And these guys are trying to take that away. So there'll be a discussion about it at some point. And even if it's heated or angry, I think there's always a good thing that comes out of it at the end, whether it be, and I agree with you, sort of communicate. And that just goes into how I think the maturity of how to handle a mass of people is literally in the idea of, oh, wait, I made a mistake. There's if he was to say the tobacco ban is based on a health issue and this is the real issue about it, people will go, ah, I get it. Because we, for a long time, masks were a big debate. Like, what the hell's wrong? Why masks? And someone literally just started communicating and said, no, you protect. It's more to just protect other people than yourself. You know, like there's a logic that happens. And it took a bit of explaining to me as well. And I'm like, oh, okay, I understand now. Now we're in kind of, that's why you see everybody wearing it, because they understood the logic behind it at least, where no one's explained any of these other rules to us. And it makes no sense. Business owners haven't been explained properly. And also to go like, oh yeah, your government can try and throttle your business, so you need to set up systems, organize, have your unions now have to actually start coming into play because you're paying them a part of your salary in order to represent your interests, and now they're going, well, where are my interests being represented? Why am I paying this? So that kind of stirs up the pot, and I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. It is a good thing. Change is never easy. And, you know, any system as dysfunctional in your system psychology, when the system works, doesn't matter how dysfunctional it is, it works because everybody in the system agrees that this is going to work. And then you get the perturbations. And every time there's a perturbation from the side, it shakes up everything in the system. to reassess and readdress. Mm. So change is always good and change is always painful. But to go through change, especially in a country, people need a leader. We need somebody to follow. We need somebody to tell you. We need something to believe in, that we're going to get out of this alive and hopefully, and we're going to get out of this being all right. In President Ramaphosa's defense, the other world leaders aren't doing so great either. I think simply because nobody's ever dealt with that. But we need communication. We need him to tell us that he doesn't know what to do. If he would just tell us that, things would make different. I just caught a quote that I wrote down here. What somebody said is that we are watching people go through withdrawal from the emotional addiction to the myth of certainty.
Mm. Wow.
That certainty we've had in our life has always been a myth. Nothing has ever been certain in our life. Yes, but that is in our human nature. We want to be certain. I want to know where I'm going to be in 10 years' time. I want to know where my job is going. I want to be certain, and I want somebody to tell me where it's going to be. Our emotional withdrawal from the emotional addiction to the myth of certainty. That's the one thing we're really battling with at the moment. Because
that's such a good way of putting it. Yeah. It's really, it puts it in context that we're addicted to certainty. And it's an illusion of certainty. A guy I used to work with, he said, I said, oh, but are you going freelance? He goes, aren't you worried about not having a stable, permanent job? He says, there's no such thing as a permanent job. Just that's an illusion you've made up in your head. Mm. There is no such thing. Your employer can tomorrow change his mind. Anything can happen. So it's an illusion. And to make another thing about like post-war countries tend to come out of it very positive. They have this kind of idea of like the future looks good because it's comparatively better than what it was a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
They have to train themselves. Otherwise, it's hopeless.
Mm.
There's the alternative is despair, and I find it the level should be neutral and deal with whatever comes up as you go along. I can't believe it, like an addiction to certainty is great, but the politicians at the moment, I find it funny with Trump and his media, his press releases or his media. He does
briefings.
Media briefings, yes, where he goes, we're handling this well. We're handling this well, considering we're handling this well. He's not saying we're fixing it. He says we're handling this well.
But he's convinced himself.
Yes, completely.
He's trying to convince everybody else.
But that's and I think people look at it and they feel a little bit uneasy, but at the same time they go, at least he's talking. At least he's saying positive things instead of we're all screwed. And it's all relative at the moment. If anything, we're going to look back at this, I hope, and go like how effective fear is to control and manipulate a population in little things. Like even if you're in heightened fear, take away people's cigarettes, it inflames. You go like, okay, cool.
What are the
triggers and the strings that can be pulled? And this is now me looking at from the outside in, and it's almost entertaining if it wasn't so real in its, because I think like the economic repercussions are going to be, that's going to be the thing that's going to kick us in the teeth.
Well, that's the other thing that I've been seeing is like for the past 2 weeks, we very much, maybe it's a Cape Townian thing. I've only been back in Cape Town for about 7 or 8 months, and I never realized how clicky Cape Town can be. 7 or 8 years. How clicky Cape Town can be. I've forgotten about that. So, you know, we're very much, I think our community in Cape Town has sort of, possibly countrywide as well, we've sort of divided into three groups. And these three groups are all entitled in their opinion. And we've got this constant fighting. And the first group are the ones who are actually taking this whole threat seriously. You know, the second group are the ones who are really concerned about the impending economic devastation that's going to affect us all. And the third group is worried about the expansion of the authoritarian government policies. And the point, you know, so you've got these three groups arguing with one another, and a lot of civil disobedience coming in. I'm not taking this seriously. And we should actually all subscribe to all three of these views. And on a more personal level as well, when you see who you in lockup with, you have families and partners who subscribe to these different groups. So can you imagine being in lockdown with a person with a totally opposing view as you? So where you might take it very seriously and try and arrange the household and going out of the household, and the other person is intent on being civilly disobedient. So it's causing a lot of conflict in communities, in societies, in families. So that is a lot of what the anger that I'm seeing at the moment is, sort of debating this endlessly. I'm moderator on a few of the social media groups in the area, so I'm leaving them all. I can't stand this anymore. This fighting about all this, because we need to be concerned about all three of these factors, not just one or two of them. We don't need to pick one and just stick with that.
Sure. I think that's very wise advice, is that it kind of harks back to that idea of being able to hold conflicting ideas in your mind without, you know, without going completely crazy. You know, there are these three factors, and, you know, we should try to pay attention and accept the fact that other people have different opinions, which is fine, but, you know, be a little bit accepting of other people's issues, because I've also, I mean, within our household, we're four adults staying here right now, and my mother-in-law, it's weird that, like, and this is just anecdotal, you know, it's anecdotal stories I'm hearing, is that older people who are the most at threat from COVID-19 appear to be more resistant to the idea of taking it seriously. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but they seem to be like, oh, don't worry about it, bugger, nothing, it's just a flu or whatever it might be, and they're literally the people who are going to die if they get it. So it's a strange, there's a strange conflict in the evidence.
That difference I see, you know, what is underlying on all our anger? All our anger and all our confusion, what is the real big thing that we're not talking here? It's fear of death. We are scared of dying.
Sure.
So when you reach the 80s or your 90s, you're not that scared of dying because it's so close. My mom's 83, she's not always lucid, but it's interesting having discussions with her about the situation to see how she perceives it. And my partner's 95 or 96-year-old grandmother last night, and she's in Durban, and she's updated with everything that's happening, but we must just wait it out, and she's very positive. So, yeah, these different ideas, but I think a lot of this is we have lost control. There is nothing as scary as the feeling that you don't have control over anything in your life. At this stage, we have lost control of our freedom. We've lost control of our dignity in a lot of ways. We're being treated like children. We've lost control of our democracy, which we all feel entitled to after 26 years. We've lost control of our job. We've lost control of our finances. You've lost control of your household, of your relaxation, of seeing your family again, of going to visit somebody, of going to the beach. We've lost control of our lives. We've lost control of our government. We've lost control of our world. And that is terrifying. So where do we go from here? So then you have people, if they feel that they don't have a lot of control over the big things, they start nitpicking the smaller things. Hopefully you don't share a household with any one of them, the ones who have obsessively started cleaning and rearranging cupboards, because that would just drive me crazy. But that is a form of trying to maintain control. Being absolutely over, have repainted the house in the past 3 weeks if they were lucky enough to have paint. But have started policing and being the head girl for the whole community as well, because you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. That is their way of trying to get control over their lives, because we do not have any control over this.
Right.
You can chuck your mask away as far as you like, and you can go up and down the streets and you probably won't get COVID. But somebody else might, because you don't have any control over that. We are all just winging it day to day, minute by minute, without a single idea of what we are doing. And that includes everybody from the topest tier of government way down to the bottom. Nobody knows what they're doing. Everybody's just trying to get by day by day.
Yeah.
And sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't go well.
Yeah.
So that loss of control, I think, is a very big issue. And what you normally find after trauma, when people have been exposed to a traumatic event, there are so many, well, that was in that article that you read as well, you know, about all the the cognitive feelings about that. You know, how many people have been saying they're so tired? I don't know why I'm so tired. I'm at home. I'm not really working at the moment, but I'm exhausted. Mm. And I'll speak with the family over Zoom and connect with everybody, but I'm exhausted. It's when your body goes into this fight or flight mode, you've got that constant anxiety. We've been in fight or flight mode for the past, what are we, day 40 today. So for at least the past 40 days, and that is the equivalent of absolutely driving with your car in red revs, as high as you can go.
Yeah.
So our bodies have been depleting as we go on. Our bodies have been burned out. We are trying to get physical rest. So you might have 3 or 4 hourly naps during the day and battle to sleep at night, but you don't get the rest because your brain can't shut off, because your brain is trying to make sense of this. And the way the body is structured, the way your brain is structured from impulse to from the minute you receive the impulse to the recognition of the brain and the subsequent action to the impulse, your brain goes through previous experiences and to see, okay, so if you see somebody pointing a pistol at you, your brain immediately goes through your brain, okay, when did I see this before? Oh, it was previously, I was hijacked previously. Right, so we go to those feelings that you get.
Right.
If it was something, no, police have pistols, police wear pistols, and they saved us one day, right? So you've got that effect. So what's happening now, our brains are trying to make sense of this limbo that we're in. And it keeps on going through the folders of previous experiences. No, we've never had this before, never had this before. So what the brain does then, if there's no prior experience to relate to, it goes into anxiety mode and fight or flight because there's an enemy that we can't identify that we've never seen before. So we have been in fight or flight for 40 days now. Mm. We are exhausted. We are angry. We are on edge. We are not doing well because of that. And then you've got a large component that I'd like to speak a bit about later on. It's about the collective grief and the loss and how we're dealing with all the losses and the grief that we're going through. There's something I just want to read to you. It's way too much to try and memorize it. Zoom sessions. As wonderful as they are, for the first 3 weeks, it was awesome. We're just going to work from home via Zoom. I'm going to see my clients. I'm going to have great counseling sessions as well. And everybody's going to continue. I'm going to check in with the family, and I'm going to do that. And all of a sudden, after 3 weeks, you know, it's really not working so well. I'm so exhausted at the end of the day. So I need to read this to you to try and make sense. It was written by somebody, Gian Piero Petri Gleri. Excuse me, Gian Piero, for that pronunciation. But he explains why we're so exhausted after the video calls. And I'd like to find out if you found the same thing in your line of work as well.
Yeah.
It's the plausible deniability of each other's absence. Our minds tricked into the idea of being together when our bodies feel we are not. And that results in dissonance, and dissonance is exhausting. It's easier being in each other's presence or in each other's absence than in the constant presence of each other's absence.
Wow.
Our bodies process so much context and so much information in encounters that meeting on video is being a weird kind of blindfolded. We sense too little and we can't imagine enough. And that single deprivation requires a lot of conscious effort.
Yeah.
So we have got this dissonance of trying to connect electronically, which we try to substitute the right thing with, and that is actually exhausting us because that is causing our dissonance. So while our brain is in flight or fight mode with no real solution because the brain still hasn't recognized what the enemy actually is, what are we fleeing from? What are we scared of? And then we have this cognitive dissonance at the same time. Why the technological options aren't working for us.
I got to say, it's an interesting thing. So when I, and this is a personal thing, because I work with people all over the world, and we connect via Skype, but only audio. And it takes the edge off, strangely enough.
It does.
Because I find these sessions are informative because we do it via video so that I can get context. I can, if I said something wrong, you're nodding or you're frowning, and I can kind of, but my subconscious, I must admit, is going nuts and second guessing and doing all that stuff to make sure Because yes, you're right. We're very conscious of each other's bodies, hand gestures. You can see my hands are moving right now. But and there's a lot of empathy that goes with interpreting that.
It has been awesome in connecting us. But it's only now that we are reliant on technology that we realize how much we need human connection. Mm-hmm. A technological connection will never be able to be a substitute for human connection. I'm sure all of us have the past 40 days. I mean, all you want to do is just see your friends and your loved ones and your children, your parents, and just hug them. Yeah. You just need to touch them. I feel so much for the people who are in lockdown alone because this is all they have to rely on. I think I would go absolutely crazy if I had to be in lockdown on my own and not having that human connection, the real life flesh and blood connection. Yeah. So once again, yeah, Zoom is great, but it's not the real thing. You know, that's another scary thing, that this is going to be our reality for the next how many months still, that we won't be able to have a real thing. We've seen that in the mental health industry as well, that we initially thought, oh, wow, you know, business owners, boom, counselors and psychologists at last, you know, we're going to get really roaring practices. It has dwindled down to virtually nothing for the simple reason that people do not want to go for therapy online because they lose out on the connection. Hmm. It helps in absolute desperate situations, but they need to sit in a room with somebody. You need that nonverbal connection in a look or just in a touch or just the presence of somebody, somebody who's been isolated and alone for a long time, you know, the smell of somebody's perfume or the aftershave or just something that we need to connect to. So people are not making use of counseling facilities at the moment as much as we anticipated for the simple reason that online is a big burden. Secondly, they can't afford to because of financial insecurity. Who can afford to pay for anything at the moment?
Yeah.
Thirdly, the medical aids have been absolutely obstructive, and the HBCSA has been so obstructive in the ethics and the use of Zoom, which has sort of blocked a lot of people out. We are supposed to be critical services, but that leaves us in the position of, are you going to let strange people still come into your rooms and risk exposure, or are you going out to see strange people and risk exposure, which is not a sensible thing to do at this stage. We all have families to take care of and all of our lives to take care of as well. So there's a lot of people out there hurting a hell of a lot and needing somebody to talk to. But the facilities we hear, but we're not accessible for various reasons. And at the same time, what I felt from some of my colleagues and myself included, we are going through the same thing. If I see a client who's been through horrendous trauma, I'm objective. So I'll be able to facilitate and support the client in what they're going through, strictly according to ethics. If I have to speak to somebody now about going through the same experience that we are sharing, I'm not objective,
right?
Because I'm going through the same thing at the same time. So you're not really effective at the moment. Yeah. And a lot of people find that they try and talk about that and it's like, oh, we're just moaning about the same thing. So I just find it quite ironic that at this time that we thought we really need all the mental health we can support.
Yeah.
The one thing that is, to go back to what you were saying, Lucas, the one thing that does work well at this stage are telephone conversations and WhatsApp conversations. Instead of having a full counseling session, you know, just a quick checkup, how are you doing today? And that's it, just, you know, just tell me how you're doing today. Okay, was it better than yesterday? Right. So today's been a good day. So daily little quick checkups is actually more effective to keep the connectivity going and to keep the human connection going than to try and do a session at the moment. I believe that the majority of us do not have the capacity for concentration at the moment because we have got this underlying anxiety of not knowing what's going to happen. Now you're trying to concentrate, you're trying to meet deadlines, you're trying to be motivated about your work. It's physically and emotionally impossible at this stage.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that there are different little tips that we can take out of probably this talk about, like, if you are feeling the mental fatigue, and I like what you just said, that there is, okay, then go on to phone, check in shorter bursts, all in the aim of being of trying to make the best of a bad situation. Because look, I think, like we said, I think your analogy of the of you going through the same crisis that we are, so it's weird to give advice. So I'm on fire. No, I'm on fire. It's the one. You know, like, yeah, I guess we're all on fire now. But here's a bit of water at least, something that we can share.
Yeah.
And there are all those little things.
I think, I mean, as you said, like objectivity is a very important part of counseling, but empathy is also a massive part of it. And at least there's a kind of an enhanced shared empathy of the situation, which is good. When we spoke last week, you said that you had a couple of clients in the film production industry, in the creative industry, and we had an interesting conversation about how, you know, introversion versus extroversion, and how a lot of creative people do tend to be introverts. And when we went into lockdown, there were a lot of memes going around about introverts just loving it. Like, this is just life for me. It's great. And in some cases, as you say, a lot of external traumas and pressures were taken away because suddenly we're safe in our little hidey holes. When it comes to your clients and people in the creative industry, the freelancing industry, what are your thoughts about how they might be reacting to the pandemic in different ways or the same ways that other people? What effects are you seeing for, if there is such a thing as a creative type, what are you seeing in that world?
A lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of overthinking, getting caught in that circle of overthinking, you know, especially most freelance people, you work with deadlines. And with people with anxiety, introverts with anxiety, procrastination is a big thing. So for procrastinators, they need deadlines because they've all managed to convince themselves through the years, and I'm talking as one myself, that I do my best work at the last minute. I'm more creative. You know, I would walk for weeks with all the words of what I want to write in my head, but I never actually get down to write it until like an hour before it's due type of thing. Mm. So I think that is very taxing at the moment. And then at the same time, I think there's a lot of comparison going on at the moment. Now, how are you doing in lockdown? How am I doing? No, I'm great. What, you know, people have started baking. Why have they started baking? Why have they started eating? Why has everybody picked up weight? Because they're looking for some kind of comfort. Mm. You know, and that's a comfort food. A lot of creative people do find other outlets for their work, but I would say the anxiety probably would have exacerbated, definitely, and trying to find solutions. You know, this is the volunteer firefighters where I'm their volunteer counselor as well. I have noticed that quite a lot of people in key positions are anxiety sufferers. And then I did some research on that, and it says, you know, that ever you're locked up or in a dangerous situation, try and be with somebody who suffers from anxiety, because they've already overthought every single variable there can be to that situation. So you are so safe with them because they thought of everything. You don't have to worry about it. And I think in this situation as well, depression links to the past. People have depression of things what have happened in the past. Anxiety is linked to the future. So anxiety is always the uncertainty of the future, trying to take control of the future, trying to plan your life ahead, trying to meet the deadlines that you might have for yourself, trying to make sure that you have work coming in for the next few months, putting a lot of pressure on yourself. I have to be motivated. I have to be at this stage. I have to be creative. I have to be able to produce amazing work. And then you sit down the whole day, and at the end of the day, you haven't done one single thing. And then you go into the next spiral of anxiety because I've wasted the whole day, but I was so exhausted I couldn't come up with anything. Okay, I'm going to try again tomorrow. So I think a lot of people are very much caught in that. And then at the same time, people working from home or freelance, you have quite a lot of a dual world. You are the very competent professional person that, and your public persona that you present to the people you do your work for. And then you are the person at home who falls apart from anxiety and slobs around in pajamas for 2 or 3 days at a time that you don't want other people to see. So I think there's a lot of that happening, that it's even an effort to go onto Zoom to get out of your pajamas and be dressed presentable. So I would say look, people who work from home need a lot of self-discipline to be able to do it to begin with. You need structure. That's what everybody always says, get yourself a routine. When people go into any kind of psychiatric home or into the military or any kind of rehab as well, there's a structure, because structure gives you comfort and structure gives you a feeling of safety. So for the first 3 weeks, I had my alarm set out for the whole day, tea time, lunch time, and then I'm going to start working on this, then I'm going to start working on this, all my alarms going off. I switched it off last week because I wasn't sticking to it, which under the circumstances is an unreal ideation. It's a very unreal thing. So what I would say for people, don't try and pretend that you are actually at this stage going through a normal phase of life, because you're not. You can't continue doing the work in the normal way. Sorry, there was another thing I wanted to get to you that I can't find now. So you have to sort of readjust. And what I've just felt to myself and what I've been advising to clients at the moment that I do chat to, one thing a day. Just commit to doing one thing a day. If it's a big thing or if it's a small thing, it doesn't really matter. But decide the night before, what's that one thing you're going to do tomorrow? And stick to it, because at least you have a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day, that you haven't wasted the whole day. And if that one particular day you're feeling particularly anxious or low, or, you know, there's this sense of self that we are losing. Because we need to be that other person for work. We need to dress up and present our work to others. We need that confidence to keep us going, because once you get the feedback from work, that gives you the courage and, you know, the motivation to go and do another job again to the best of your ability. We are lacking that at the moment. A lot of people who rely on their work for their self-image to come through, you know, to boost their self-confidence, are really battling at the moment because they are excluded from that. They're not getting that affirmation. They're not getting that look in the eye of being with somebody in the room and that person saying, wow, this is a really good job.
Right.
They're not getting any of that. As far as the motivation is concerned, maybe this will put it into perspective for you as well, especially in your industry, Maslow's hierarchy of motivation, hierarchy of needs. On your bottom one, you've got your physiological, and then you've got your safety, then you've got your love, and then you've got your esteem, and then you've got your self-actualization. So most of us in the demographic you were talking about have already been on level four, pushing for level five. You know, we've already got the esteem of having achieved something in life, you're working at a certain level, and you're aiming for self-actualization. You want to get to that thing that has been, that's a bit more. We have all worldwide, it doesn't matter what your economic status is or your educational status worldwide, we have all been chucked down to go back to your first basic needs in the hierarchy, and that is your physiological needs. You need food, you need a place to stay, you need money to survive. That is a physiological need to buy the food. You need to be safe, you need to be healthy, you need to be protected from whatever can kill you, and that goes part of your level two, your safety. So while you are focusing, while your whole life and your whole brain is obsessing about need one and two, about the physiological needs and the safety needs, there is no way you can jump from level one or two to level four and expect your esteem to be on the self or even try to self-actualize at this moment.
Right.
So we need to be kind with ourselves now. We are all going through the worst time in most of our lives that we can remember. I was saying to somebody the other day, oh my word, we thought load shedding was bad. We thought the drought was bad. I mean, I'm not saying anything about COVID, because who knows what's going to be next. You know, it's like just as soon as you think we've had it all, there's something new that pops up. So please, I'm not challenging anybody to chuck anything our way. but yeah, so, you know, I think people in your industry who thrive on the anxiety, they thrive on the stress, they thrive to do their best work, must be cognizant of the fact that they will not be able to do it now. And then at the same time, you have to deal with the anxiety of losing income, which is a very big anxiety that everybody's battling with. So as far as the sorry, I'm just looking at my notes. You know, so as far as the practicalities are that you're talking about, you know, what do we need How can we do this?
Hmm.
Nobody knows. There's nothing I can tell you to do. We have come to this situation where we basically everybody's on their own, as terrible as it sounds. So what we need to do is, you asked about one of your questions, you asked about social media as well.
Hmm.
As much as you try not to go on social media, your brain keeps on telling you, I need information because I want to understand this. So then you go back to social media and then you're confused again. Then you have millions of opinions. So what I found that helps with me, because I'm prone to anxiety as well, I've chosen one or two sources that I found to be reputable, and I only look at them. I do not read the comments anymore because that drives me absolutely insane.
Sure.
I do not rely on other people's opinions anymore. I need facts that I feel I can trust. So those are the ones that I go to. And then obviously I have a few trusted people that I discuss it with. So for me, it's very much as far as everything in life is concerned at this moment, you have to look at what are your needs? What are you battling with at the moment? What can you do? If you find a lot of comfort in social media and find a lot of comfort in hearing other people's opinions, because hearing somebody's opinions during normal circumstances, it either reaffirms your opinion or it helps you adjust your opinion accordingly by having new information coming in. But at this stage, we are getting so much information. We remember our brains are busy with this dissonance as well, because you're trying to pretend that life is normal, but it's not normal. So the more you try and convince your brain, nothing's different. You know, it's just a little hiccup. The more the brain's saying, you know, I know you're lying to me. So you've got your brain telling you totally different things. So to try and fool yourself to think that this is normal, it's not working at all. So you need to find your own truth. In all this, you need to find your truth. You need to find the truth that you believe in, that you think is the truth, upon the information that is out there. Follow the ones that you find sits well with you. Speak to people whose opinions affirm yours, who you believe is in line with your truth. Don't get into confrontational subjects with somebody at this moment. Don't fight about something that's really not going to make any difference, because you're wasting valuable energy and you're really exhausted and you're not going to be able to change anything. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's just about find your truth, speak your truth and live it. If you do not have the capacity to do your work full time at this moment, do what you can do. If you are expected, a friend of mine's a copywriter, and I know she has got loads of work at this moment, and she's really battling because her body cannot deal with the stress of the work at the moment because of everything that we've discussed previously, and she's really battling. So what happens then is you have all the physical symptoms coming up. You've got the headaches, you've got the tiredness, you've got the muscle aches, you've got all those other aches and pains. You've got indigestion because you've been eating a lot more than we normally do. So your body is protesting and telling you to just take this easy. So that is part of your truth. Listen to your body and listen to your mind to see what you can do, what you can handle. And unfortunately, that is the best that I have to offer, is we all need to find a way. I'm not objective on your life. You know what you need in your life. Lucas knows that, Lucas, what you were talking about earlier on, looking after your physicality as well and making sure that you remain strong, that is your priority. Me battling with anxiety, that is my priority, to keep my anxiety in order. If you already have a mental health condition like anxiety or depression, this is a really, really dangerous time. There are a lot of people who try to go off their meds at this stage, or who are battling to get hold of their meds because some of the supplies have been disrupted as well. They are really going through an incredibly difficult time. So that is the best that I have to offer.
Right.
If I can build on, it's an interesting thing that you said, everybody has their own way of doing, of dealing with things, and have to find that one thing that they do. One friend of mine, he's a very, very physical person. So he just before the lockdown, he came to borrow a boxing bag of mine, and he shares his videos of him making makeshift boxing kind of rigs so he can keep himself busy physically. So, and that's his way of getting it out. I've got a personal thing about, if you're in the shit, you can work yourself out of the shit. When I was sick, I would just draw the whole time to keep my mind busy. At the moment, I'm working, I'm enjoying it. It keeps my mind off the stuff and keeps you off social media. So, and with John, I think John John's pouring everything he has into his own projects at the moment. So there is a productive side to this, to dealing with what I've found, at least partially dealing with anxiety or depression. And everybody will have their own way of doing it. But I think that the gauge, I suppose, is, are you being productive? Is it something positive that does come out of it at the end of the day? But yeah, it's refreshing to hear someone say, also say, like, look, we don't have the answers. There are no answers. It's a case by case, person by person, how you kind of move forward. Mm. But it's a personal philosophy about, at least let's make something out of this. Let's make something. Because the alternative of sleeping, and that hole if you just sleep all day, that the hole is going to get deeper and deeper and deeper.
I think creative freelancers.
Behavior.
Sorry, I just think that for a lot of creatives, creating is their coping mechanism for some kind of trauma they might have had, or just their way of it's expressing themselves, and that's a way it's their own personal therapy. So, in many cases, I think that will be something that helps, but obviously there will be exceptions to that. So kind of what you're saying, I guess, is to listen, try and listen to yourself. What is making, maybe there's a kind of a strategy where you rate your day out of 10 at the end of every day. You kind of just literally write down, today was a 7 out of 10, today was an 8 out of 10. Or you journal, which we've done an episode about as well, using journaling to examine your feelings and say, okay, this made me happy, this made me stressed. Track what is working and what's not working, and try and develop your own routine and your own system of therapy for yourself to get you through this. Sorry, Amanda.
So, what I often do with clients is, especially when you battle with depression and anxiety, the thought of actually writing a journal and verbalizing everything can be very daunting. So what we normally do is just work in color. You can use a highlighter in your diary, and I found with some clients even your Lego blocks. So you just choose three colors that have some significance for you, and at the end of the day you just put your Lego block there, where you just have green stripe through your day. So at the end of the week you can look back over the day and you can start seeing a pattern in your moods and how you're doing. So that's quite an easy very visual thing to be able to do it. So that always works. I particularly like the Lego blocks, because you line them up on the windowsill or on the table somewhere, and you have a quick overview of how your week has been doing. And it's been quite a few green days, so it's cool. It's not too bad. That is the one thing. And I've forgotten the other thing. Sorry. So go ahead.
Well, the example you made, one of the main things that John was talking about was the journaling was, it was called pixel journaling, and it was on a calendar where you literally just kind of color in the block, and whatever color you assign to it works as well. And so it's just those little things that, weirdly enough, when you look into it, like that one thing that you could do that day could be just that. And then at the end of the week, there's something you've made, whether it be a track of your emotions or not. There is something, at least there's something that's come out of it, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's something else that I'd like to add on that. Sorry, John.
No worries.
I'd like to add on that as well, is we have this thing that we have to be positive. There's a whole thing about toxic positivity that really drives me absolutely insane, where you have these people that are so positive, they go into positivity so much and try and be positive so much that they're actually in full denial without realizing it and without knowing that. So I hate people saying or telling somebody else to be positive. No, I don't want to be positive at the moment. I don't expect anybody else to be positive. Be realistic and have your small goals and go with baby steps. But don't try and be all little in the sunshine today, because you're not going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. At the same time that I advise clients very often, when you have these days that you wake up, I always say that, the days that you wake up and you look in the mirror and you don't see anybody, then you know it's a bad day. And those are the days that you just want to get back into bed and just cut the whole world out. But no, society tells us to be positive. Our family tells us to be positive. Our work demands it. Why don't you take that day and have a wallow day? Really take that day and go into your feelings. What am I feeling today? Cry, scream, shout, be physical if you want to, but really take that day and go into the deep, dark feelings that we're all trying to push away and really explore those feelings. But the trick is to allow yourself limited time. You can negotiate, okay, I'm going to do this today, and then tomorrow I'm going to take stock of what I actually aimed, you know, what I achieved in this day. And it actually works wonders. By people giving themselves permission that I am allowed to feel down and depressed. I am allowed to feel all doomy and gloomy. You know, we've got this thing every night, and it's like, okay, you know, what are we going to watch tonight? I don't know. What do you want to watch tonight? And it's always the same thing, you know, okay, anything but doom and gloom and anything but COVID. So we've been discovering amazing things to watch. But something that takes your mind off, and something that gives you a little bit of life affirmation. You know, it's like this whole COVID thing. It's got this death shroud all over it, and nobody talks about that. We're all trying to deny this, that this whole thing is about death. Even though the death percentages aren't so high yet, especially in South Africa, we don't come near what are the other countries are like. But it's like the weirdest thing that people do not talk about death, and that is what we're all afraid about.
Yeah.
We need to embrace that. We need to start thinking about that. You know, the minute you become aware of your own mortality, now you're in the situation that we don't know where we're going to from here. I don't know if I'm going to get the virus. If I do get the virus, am I going to survive? To what degree will I get it? Do I have any pre-existing conditions that might make it more difficult for me? And then you start thinking, what can I do now because I feel so helpless? There are little things like, do you have a will? We are facing a pandemic. Do you have a will? Do you have life insurance? I mean, the policies have already been gone up like crazy since this has started. Are your affairs in order? These are the practical things you can keep yourself busy with. What is going to happen to my house if I get this? Do I have medical coverage? Which hospital will I go to? Get those practicalities out of the way, because those are the things that we don't want to think about them, and those are the things that creep up on you at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you don't necessarily want to discuss that with your family or with your partner, because we are, us in the Western society, are so terrified of death and talking about death. Life ends in death for everybody. We are all scared of dying at this stage. We are all scared of dying a horrible death at this stage. Because from what we hear, it's really not a peaceful death. We don't think about that. We don't talk about that. Maybe if we actually have these discussions, it will take a lot of the anxiety off us to try and deny the reality of that. And I've got two more points that I'd like to discuss. But Jonathan, you were trying to say something. Sorry, before I butted in.
No, not at all. I think that's – please go ahead. What else, go ahead with your 2 points.
There's just one thing I want to read here. It's coronavirus grief is already a vast monster's grief. Its reach and breadth expanding daily. It's also a collective grief. It's a worldwide loss that physically isolated through many of us have to be. A lot of other people are in one way or another also mourning. And I think that's a very important that a lot of us are missing at the moment. I'm sure both of you and I have, in the beginning of the stages, I'm not a crier. I've learned through the years not to cry because I hear so many stories from other people. If I have to break down and cry every time, I'll be absolutely useless. But I've been moved to tears how many times in the first few weeks of COVID? And the only way that I could explain it is it's this wave of grief, this overwhelming hurt and grief for what the world is going through. There are so many people going through immense hardships. You know, when you see footage of some of the other cities, you see these amazing cities always thronging with tourists, and they empty, they almost look ghost-like. We are grieving the world. We are all going through a grieving process. We are grieving life as we knew it. We have lost life as we knew it. We need to be able to look at that grief and to actually give ourselves time to grieve. We are going to take a very long time to get through this grieving process, but you get different kinds of grief as well and different kinds of losses. Where you have a death, you have a finite grief, because that's somebody passed away. There was a loss of life, and there's a grieving process that goes with that. A lot of times in that death, that's where you differentiate between a crisis and a trauma as well. Because normally a trauma would be something that's unexpected, extraordinary, out of the realm, sudden, totally different, that you really battle to wrap your mind around. Or then it would be a trauma. Or if somebody passes off an illness, that would be a crisis in the family. So now we have people passing off an illness, but it's a trauma. So there's this whole different way of processing that. So that would be a finite death. And that would, each one of them would have a certain way that people grieve the loss through that. Then you have a non-death loss. Is also a type of grieving we're going through. That's normally, that's anything that's significant to you. You know, if you go through a divorce, you lose the connectivity and you lose that feeling of being part of a couple. You probably lose your house and the dog and a lot of finances as well. So you have all that. That's a non-death loss, which leads on to your secondary loss as well, where you lose, for instance, divorce, you lose, once again, finances, your friends, the community by moving. You lose your sense of security. You lose your place in society. What we're experiencing a lot at the moment is an ambiguous loss, that you're never quite sure of who and what you are losing or who and what you've already lost. And it also appears when something or somebody profoundly changes or disappears. It's a loss of the way that you knew it. And you're torn between hope for the return to normal and the looming sense that life, as you know it, is fading fast. It's never going to be the same again. Yeah. So we can't go back to what we perceive to be normal, but we're not there at the end of the grieving process to know what it's going to be like. Mm. So this is this very ambiguous loss that we can't actually quite pinpoint what you're grieving. A lot of us haven't lost our houses yet. We haven't lost our jobs yet. We still have food to eat, but a lot of people have. So they would be on the finite death with the ambiguous loss together with that. Then you have the cumulative losses and you have the non-finite losses. You know, the non-finite losses is if your life doesn't turn into your childhood dreams.
Yeah.
None of us had a childhood dream where a pandemic comes into play. A lot of us are at the pinnacle of our careers watching it go down the drain. Yeah. My son's a chef who's worked his whole life to be a brilliant chef. And the possibility is that the restaurant's going to close and the whole hospitality industry has taken a big knock. So, you know, that would be a lot of people who have spent their whole life working in a specific area that has now become redundant. So that would be that non-finite loss. Everything you've invested in your life, you sort of see dwindling away in front of you and you have absolutely no control about that. Your anticipatory grief, which is self-explanatory, we talked about that earlier on. We know the losses are coming. I don't know if any of you know anybody personally who have passed from COVID-19 yet, but it's coming soon. We are going to hear about that pretty soon, and it's going to touch us very soon. I had family members who have just come out of, they were overseas, and they just come back into the country. Into quarantine, and they've both just tested negative. So it's such a relief to know that they have tested negative, but there are a lot of people, we are anticipating to lose people.
Sure.
And we could be anticipating to lose our own lives as well. We don't know because we can't say. Disenfranchised grief, that is something that a lot of people would be experiencing after the death of corona, as well as denied the right to grieve by family and friends. If you lose anybody in your family at the moment, not being able to go to the funeral, going through those last rites, that's going to leave you with anger for the rest of your life. So, you know, we are going through such a big time of loss and grief while our brains are trying to understand all this, that this whole pandemic has turned into this existential dread. That we really have to come to the point that we have to look at death at this stage. I'm sorry if I sound like the Grim Reaper, but you know, this is for me, this whole thing is about death, and people do not want to talk about that. Take that time and take that effort and talk to your family members about death. In your household, have you discussed what if one person in the household becomes infected? Do you have a quarantine area? Have you got a plan of action already? You know, these are little things you can do to take off some of that anxiety of the uncertainty. Right. What are we going to do if we both get infected? If we both get infected, that's fine. We'll try and take care of each other as best as we can. But if one person gets infected, what are we going to do this? And like I said, the practicalities of your will, your insurance policies. Does your life policy cover you in this pandemic? That is something that has come up a few times that people are actually not sure whether they will be covered or not. So these are some of the things, because those are the unspoken worries that we have. Address them, meet them head on, and do them. And that will take some of the anxiety off as well. So once again, that goes back to finding your truth. And this is like trauma. Any trauma is a personal experience. So how you experience this pandemic, how Lucas experiences and how I experience it is totally, totally, totally different. But it's our journey to do. We have to do it the way I see fit. You know, if
there's that makes any sense. Yeah. There's an interesting thing you said about that. We're all grieving, that, and it's a pattern, and that your tears that are that sit so close to the surface. It's that we're the planet's a living organism, and there's a sense of energy that moves around it. And I'm sounding like a hippie now, but it's showing itself. And in this mass anxiety thing that we have, that emotions will run high, and those feelings do come out. And it's just fascinating to see it on such a global scale, because this will be the first time we've seen war, and it's usually over there. It's those guys over there. And the more CNN or whoever these global news networks cover, we tend to have it at an arm's length. We keep it at a distance. And now that it's all so close, because I also went like the moment I because personally you read all the stories and the conflicting evidence and you go like, yeah, man, it's a hoax. And then my girlfriend's friend's husband gets it in England, and they locked him in the attic and had to treat him there. And it was like, oh, okay, that's close. That's way too close now. So you kind of have this kind of teetering feeling. And also the idea, and this is might be conflicting with you a little bit on this idea of embracing death. I think there's something that you have to embrace the thought, the idea of death.
And we're back for another quick restart. Sorry, Luke, can you pick up where you left off there?
Yeah, it was just on my previous, well, it was death and embracing it. And I actually think, again, and without sounding like the thing that would probably irritate you, is the positive outcome of this is that, yes, your affairs will be in order. You'll start thinking about these things, and you have the time and now the motivation to do that. But what I wanted to disagree with you about was this idea that allow yourself to the space to be have anxiety or be in it or to wallow in it. There's and we're going through through health issues. My thing was like there'd be days where like you want to die, and I got given pretty good advice from someone who was dying, and they said like lie to yourself, literally. It's if you're not feeling well, tell yourself you're feeling well, just and focus on that bit, and that's all you focus on, even if you know that you're lying to yourself, and you whatever gets you through that. So and admittedly I'm talking about dire circumstance, but the idea of framing anything in a more productive or to get a positive outcome out of a negative situation,
because that just illustrates the point of our individual experiences, because you're obviously talking from your experience as well. I'm talking from somebody who sees a lot of people with anxiety and depression. So without the health issues, I mean, you're talking from actually two different experiences then. So it works for some, but it doesn't work for all the others. But what you said as well, Luke, is that brings us back to the existential crisis, and you're talking about, sorry to sound like a hippie. I sound like a hippie a lot of times as well, so that's great. This whole pandemic has brought about a lot of spiritual crises for a lot of people. People who are believers in mainstream religion have a lot of questions they have to ask, a lot of anger they have to dispel as well. People who are more spiritual than than religious are trying to find some kind of guidance, are trying to find some kind of answers. And on the good days, I absolutely believe that this is happening because of something better. There's a lesson. We brought this upon ourselves in a lot of ways. There's always something to be learned from this, that we are in the process of learning. We were so caught up in this instant gratification of our society that we have actually been afforded the breathing space just to stop and look at what we were doing to ourselves. We had so much information that we couldn't possibly process. There are so many things, considering that makes me feel very positive about the future. Not in a toxic way, but you know that there's some little light at the end of the tunnel, but we're not there yet. We don't know which way it's going to go. And the talking about death as well is part of the existential crisis. If you go back to existentialism as well, and especially Viktor Frankl, who was all about finding your own meaning in life. And before you can find meaning in life, you have to have a will to live. And you have to realize that you have free will. And then you can find, and then realize you have the free will to make meaning. And then you find the meaning in life. So that's a whole process that I think we are going to do as well. A lot of people, I'm waiting to see what the suicide rates are going to be like in the next few weeks, because as soon as people start losing more businesses as well, and the financial pressures and the economic pressures, losing businesses and houses, I'm sure there are bound to be suicides. So, you know, talking about death is part of that finding the meaning of life. In the contrast, it's not so much embracing death. It's embracing the fact that death is a part of living. And you need to understand death and its perspective to be able to refine the meaning in life. There's a thing called Wei Ji that, I mean, it's been misattributed to President Kennedy for how many years, so nobody actually knows who the source was. But it's about the Chinese character for crisis that apparently composes of two different characters. And the one is opportunity and the other one is danger. So whenever there's a crisis, we are always first accosted by the danger and we are terrified of the danger. But as the process moves through the danger and we start learning our lessons from the danger, we get to see the opportunities in this, the opportunities for growth, the opportunities to change your own viewpoint, the opportunities to change the world, the opportunities to not make the same mistakes again. But this is something that you can't hurry. This has to be a process that you have to gradually go through to finally get there. And I'm hoping that we all will get there, some sooner than others, or at least intact and healthy as well, and with the world a better place at the end of the day.
Right. The I think
sorry, John. Yeah. That echoes the sorry, this is a bit of pop culture stuff. Is that
chaos is a ladder.
Chaos is a ladder. Game of Thrones little finger strategy of use the chaos to kind of move yourself up the ladder, I suppose. And again, it's like the principle of looking for the good in a bad situation.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
So no, absolutely, but Lucas, if you talk about that, this is our first pandemic. This is hopefully going to be our last pandemic. This is huge. Are we going to let this go by and not learn anything from it? It is such a monumentous waste to not learn anything from this. You know, we have to make meaning of this. We have to find a meaning in this. This wasn't just a random event. I don't even want to go into the conspiracy theories. But whatever started this, whatever sparked this off, whatever happened, it's monumental. It's affecting the whole world. There has to be something to learn from this. We can't just ignore this. And okay, if we survive, we just carry on as though nothing happened. So, you know, for me, it's so important that we have to find meaning in this. And that's why I'm saying, with the little things you do every day, you have to know what your truth is. You have to know what the meaning is that you are looking for in this. I will find a different meaning in this. Each one of us will look at this differently, and we will find what we need in that. We will find what we need to change.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes I get so excited about this because this is it's so huge. My daughter was saying the other day, you know, she can't believe that she actually, you know, she's lived through the millennium and now she's living through this pandemic and, you know, all these things happening in this lifetime. It's actually such an exciting time to be alive, which is sometimes not from this side, so exciting. It's bloody scary. Hmm.
It'll be in hindsight. It'll be in hindsight, exactly. Look at how much we learned during that crappy period. The unintended thing about hygiene and not mixing in at the moment. If you think about it, I think there was the doctors were talking about how other deaths have gone down. And people aren't noticing that silver lining. And it's a big thing. It's like in the world of mass communication, to get people to change their behavior is super difficult. People are now obsessed about washing their hands. And people in the world of TB, my mom was a nurse in public health. You couldn't convince people to wash their hands. But now it's a thing. You wear gloves. Everybody's super aware now. And it took this to do that.
And it should be something so logical. I mean, just imagine how many other germs you're killing in the process with the regular hand washing now. Some people say that you're actually opening up with a hand sanitizer, you're opening up yourself for more germs. But I'm quite good with them as long as they don't kill me. You know, they're quite happy to be around. But it's something as simple as hand washing. You're absolutely right. And at the same time, looking at that, that is something that was given to us as advice. This is how you can try and protect yourself by washing your hands. So everybody's holding on to it. That's a little bit of hope. Mm-hmm. You know, a piece of soap and that ritual of washing your hand is like one of the tiny little pieces of hope we have at the moment. That is the garlic that's warding off the Dracula for a lot of us. And that's something to believe in. So we really want to hold on to that. We are looking for some hope, for some kind of belief, for somebody to tell us everything's going to be all right.
Right.
Even if it's only in washing our hands.
Well, I would like to kind of provide our audience with a few more pieces of garlic to ward off that vampire. And you've already actually given it to us in the form of the article you wrote on Therapy Route, which I'll link to in the show notes so people can go and read the full article. But you gave some, you know, as you said, there's a dissonance here in that we don't have an experience prior to this that we can compare what we're going through now to. So we can't. So we were left with that dissonance, that gap. But I think that the generic general advice for mental wellness will do better than anything else at this point, you know. So in your article, you mentioned a few coping and ultimately recovery strategies. There's quite a few points there, eat healthy, well-balanced meals, all that kind of thing. Would you like to go through, if you can, some of the general good advice for mental wellness that we can employ, even if we don't have anything specifically that's going to protect us from this?
I think a lot of is avoidance behaviors. The drugs and the alcohol. I know.
Well, that's getting easier and easier.
Yeah, that's not so. But, you know, with people doing their own home brew as well, you know, to be careful, not to be too over-enthusiastic and leave it too long. And, I think people not being able to drink and not being able to smoke, people are still looking for something as an anxiety relief and something to soothe them and to help them sleep. And because other substances and over-the-counter drugs are more freely available than booze and alcohol, they might take more. You know, for instance, start taking painkillers or start taking sleeping tablets as well. So that can lead to other behavior as well. The junk food and the sugar and the salt and the caffeine, I've never had so much coffee in my life than I've had since wine has been banned.
Right.
So that's not good. That's not good for your system, you know, to avoid that. Coke is evil, especially if you already have anxiety issues, if you already have some kind of mental health issues, if you are pre-diabetic as well, and remembering at this stage that, you know, pre-existing conditions do make us more susceptible to COVID. So if you have a history of any heart problems or any diabetes or any of those vascular diseases as well, especially Coke, try and stay away from Coke. Try and look after your health as much as possible as a means to ward it off. Okay. Plenty of rest at this stage, at least 7 hours. I think everybody's battling with this because you tend to take naps during the day because you're so fatigued. So if you want to take a nap during the day, make sure it's just after lunch so it won't disrupt your evening sleep, and rather get up earlier in the morning. Mm-hmm. Those who do exercise in the morning, it's still pitch black in the morning, but it's worth the effort to get up and to get out there with all the throngs of people and to exercise if you can do that. Even if it's just a meander around the block, you are doing something. You're doing something like performing. It's a change of scenery. It's fresh air out there. You watch the dogs enjoy themselves. So that's something worth doing. A routine, if you can. Even if you work from home, even if you have a deadline to work, to make sure that you... Sorry, and I'm just jumping to something else. There's a video on YouTube. I can't remember his name. He used to be a general in the Marines. And he's got this video, this motivational speech that he does about the importance of making your bed in the morning.
Oh, yes.
And the first time I watched that, I just thought, no ways, this guy can't be serious. And I've often referred that to a lot of people because what he says makes such a lot of sense. During this lockdown and not knowing what the future is going to hold, when you get up in the morning, what motivation do you have for the day? You know, so it's like the first thing, right, go to the toilet, go to the kettle and fill up in some coffee, and then what? Then try and think about the long, empty day in front of you. Make your bed. Because making your bed, especially if you're prone to hide from life or anxiety or depression, it's so much easier to just crawl back into bed and just spend the whole day there and feel more worthless at the end of that. Little things like making your bed, sticking to a routine, get up at a specific time every morning, exercise if you want to. If you don't exercise, just have some quiet, meaningful time. Mm. My partner's obsessed. We've got a beautiful view over False Bay, mm-hmm. where the sun rises in the morning, and it looks totally different every morning, and the movement of the clouds. So I don't get up that early. So we normally do a time lapse and then watch it later on because that is something life affirming for the day. If we do get up early enough, it's great. But do something life affirming first thing in the morning, like watch the sunrise, even if it's on time lapse later on. Then get that one thing for the day. What are you hoping to achieve for the day? If you do it at 8 o'clock in the morning, then you've already got that sense, right? That's what I want you to do today. That's great. Now I can rest without feeling guilty. Tomorrow I'm going to do this. If you only get to do it at 12 o'clock at night, awesome. But do your one thing a day. Exercise, structure your time and priorities, normal basic routines. Try to stick to life as normal. It's very difficult at the moment. But if you've already worked from home before, just consider having just your same routine, but like the light version of that routine, because you won't be able to have the same output due to all the reasons we discussed on earlier on. A big thing for me that I find a lot of people have made this mistake and are talking about it at the moment is don't make any major life changes or decisions this moment.
That's classic advice for traumatic experience.
Yeah, and I mean, physically we can't go anywhere, but I've heard so many people, you know, as soon as lockdown's over, you know, I'm out of here, I'm leaving the country, I'm going here, I'm going there. Wait till you get there. Wait until it's settled afterwards before you make these major decisions. If your spouse is driving you crazy in lockdown, don't run to divorce court the minute you get out of lockdown, because it's abnormal. We are exhibiting normal behavior for abnormal circumstances at the moment. So be a bit more lenient as far as that is concerned. Making a small number of daily decisions may assert your sense of control. Little things like, what would you like for dinner tonight? I don't know, you choose. No. Why am I carrying the responsibility? Let's make a choice together. That's a tiny thing of asserting your sense of control is by making a joint decision or having one person decide what are we having for dinner tonight. It's absolutely trivial under normal circumstances. But if you get into the habit of saying, I don't know, I don't care, you are you're boycotting yourself in a lot of ways because you're going into the negative
your control.
Thinking. Absolutely, ceding your control and I don't care. I don't care what happens to me. Allow yourself time to feel down and negative and share your feelings with others. We've covered that. Spending time in nature, if you can, where you can, obviously without breaking the law, depending on which side you're on of civil obedience or disobedience. Don't be afraid to set limit with others when you don't feel like talking. My daughter and I had this discussion that, you know, about the first 2 weeks of lockdown, we would speak every day. And then after about the second week, it's like, you know, today's exactly like tomorrow.
Yeah.
And like yesterday. So there's nothing really new. So we now have more infrequent, shorter conversations via video. So we have more of a connection, and you find more quality in that. So if you don't feel like talking to somebody, you're not obliged to, because you might just be bringing the other person down. Be honest and say to that person, you know, I'm really not in the headspace at this stage of the conversation. Can I speak to you at a later stage? Just be honest. We're all feeling the same way, so just be honest. Don't sit with long conversation where you're not really invested in the conversation and you're going to bring the other person down and feel worse about yourself. I think another thing, the dreams, the recurring, people have been having quite intense dreams and very interesting dreams during the lockdown period. So I've been trying to look at that and to get people to tell me about the experiences and their dreams that they've and how it differs to their normal dreams. So that is something really interesting if you're into that, is to take note of what you're dreaming at this stage compared to your normal dreaming, and whether the dreams were in color or in black or white, and what is the general feeling of the dreams you have, because that is very often a really good indicator of what's actually happening in your subconscious. So you might be feeling that you're doing extremely well and your dreams would say otherwise, and then that would also be a reason why you're not having really good quality sleep. So that is something that I found very interesting. And then the last thing is just be patient and be kind, not only with others, but with yourself as well. We have got such a lot of empathy for everybody else going through this. We need to learn to find empathy for ourselves as well, especially if you're in some kind of a helping profession, or just being there for your colleagues, or maybe you're the friend that everybody runs to with their problems. Be kind to yourself as well, because you possibly can't deal with that at the moment. So you need to be able to tell people, that's a bit too much for me at the moment. Let's talk about this, reframe this in another way, but be kind.
I think
the rest of it is fairly self-explanatory.
And I'll throw a link up to that article in the show notes so that you can see the entire list. I'd like to kind of like wrap up by, first of all, thanking you for the time that you put into actually making notes and bringing quotes and references. And it's really amazing. And I'm so thankful for you bringing all your wisdom to us and to our listeners. I'm sure it'll be well appreciated. Can you let us know where, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you and work with you, how can they get in touch?
Okay, the easiest way would be just on social media. If they can connect with me through social media, I'm on Facebook and on Instagram, just Amanda Reichardt Counseling. They might just have difficulty with the spelling as well, so I don't know if you could put the link out there. And at the bottom of this article, I've put the links that I most often use to people for referral as well.
Right.
Lifeline is doing amazing work at the moment. They're doing Skype sessions as well, and they're doing WhatsApp calls. And of course, they are still totally free. There is the Hub Clinic in Woodstock that still do face-to-face counseling. So if it's something really out of the realm, something really unusual, and people feel they need to go somewhere, that's another place they can contact as well. And then, of course, TADX Mental Health Line. They're based in Joburg, but they do take calls countrywide as well. So they are really good resources as well. I post on my social media pages. I do a lot of posts on COVID, a lot of articles. I normally do the long articles that I post on Facebook because it's just easier to read. And it's easy for people to find it there. Then all my details are on there. They can contact me through that.
Fantastic. Great. Thank you. I think the last point that you made really, really touched hit me in terms of the empathy, essentially, for yourself and for others. And we've talked a little bit about how how social media can be a bit of a quagmire right now and all kinds of horrible things going on there. But I think something that I'll take out of this actually is just from trying to remember that all the outrage, all the toxicity, all of the reactiveness going on social media right now is a symptom of people under stress and people going through a trauma. So I'll try to be a little bit more understanding with those people rather than immediately just gainsay or get angry. You know, everyone's dealing it within their own way, and sometimes people don't have a healthy way of expressing themselves, so they jump onto especially WhatsApp groups for neighborhoods. Wow. Those can be a dangerous, scary place.
Evil. Well, We're all scared. That's the bottom line. We're all scared.
Yeah, yeah. Lucas, anything you want to say, wrap up with?
Yeah, I just want to echo. We all. I think everything's uncertain, and we hate that. And that was the essence of what you said. What I'm taking out of this is, and it's actually okay that we all feel this way. It's just we have to deal with it. I like sometimes when people say like, I'm feeling insecure, and then someone agreeing, I also feel insecure. You know, like there's a little bit of a camaraderie that happens in that, and then you feel like it's okay to be that way. So it was nice. Even like you, Amanda, you admitting, you go, I don't know. There's no answer, because there isn't an answer, because you're being truthful. But at least if anybody listening to this at least can take out of it is that it's a mixture of feelings, but we're all pretty much in the same spectrum here. We're all sitting in the same way of approaching it. Although we'll all have different ways of dealing with it. But I just echo that sentiment. I felt a little bit better after that.
Yeah.
And thanks for the free therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not busy.
Well, I will hope some people get in touch with you after this. But I think now, I think I saw a post on Facebook yesterday while I was mindlessly scrolling the infinite lengths of it, about how, like, let's not forget that what we've lost, the trauma we're experiencing from the loss of the world before, a lot of it was toxic in its own era. You know, the sense of invincibility, that you have to always be positive, that you always have to be on top of things, the fake it until you make it, the masks, you know, and the 24/7 productivity and the craziness of the world that we've lost. There are a lot of things that we're actually okay to lose. I'm finding an incredible rediscovery of like the boring moments that you would think of as boring a while ago, but now I'm treasuring, spending a lot more time with family, appreciating the behavior of my pets for some reason, which all that kind of thing. So hopefully, and to Lucas's point, that there'll be a positive outcome out of this eventually, I think, and you should try and look for it. And we do have reference points in things like the world wars, where when they ended, societies, humanity picks itself up and says, now we need to rebuild something. And one of the curses of the millennial generation is that we didn't have a cause to fight for and something to rebuild from, whereas, you know, the boomers kind of were rebuilding after World War II. So hopefully when we come out the other side of the pandemic, we'll have something to focus on building together. Wow, that sounded worthy. Okay. Amanda.
No, that's very interesting. If I can just add something interesting, if you read up on the history of post-traumatic stress, it only became a problem after the Vietnam War. And they linked that to motivation, that the previous, in the First and the Second World War, everybody went out of patriotism and to defend their country. And with the Vietnam War, they weren't emotionally and patriotically invested in the war. So the effect of that was so much more dire than in the other world wars. And I think we're in that same situation. We need to be able to get back to be patriotic and to deal with this pandemic like we did the first 3 weeks, you know, as a whole nation. So I sincerely hope that would be the first thing to change in the future, that we could all regain that feeling to get our motivation right. Because if we go through this pandemic as a divided nation, I think our chances will be not so good then.
Absolutely.
I just think it would be better if we can do this together, because you've got that motivation while everybody's going in.
Well, let's hope Cyril gets it all under control on his side of things. That would certainly help.
I really hope so. There's a lot of people believing in him, so yeah, he can't disappoint us all.
Well, thank you again for your time, Amanda. It's been an amazing interview. I'm really, really stoked to be able to post this and share it with everyone. And hopefully we'll keep in touch.
Definitely. It's really nice to meet both of you.
You too. Take care. Thanks, Amanda. Cool.
Bye.
Chat you later.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.